My approach to life is that theory informs practice and practice informs theory. This is, of course, not original, but I've tried to do that to the best of my ability all of my life. But I am, first and foremost, an organizer. That is to say, I have attempted over these many decades to bring people together, to find the most creative ways of bringing people together, to construct radical alternatives to our existing society with the objective of transforming that society in the most radical way. So I don't hesitate to identify myself as an anarchist and as a revolutionary. I have in front of me here a great deal of theory, but I'm not going to cite it or read from it, even though I'm tempted to do it, because the written word is often clearer than the spoken word. But as I said, if the rest of the day is available to you as it is to me, we can go into detail and we can quote chapter and verse. But I will say this about constructive anarchism, which is, of course, a paradox, is it not? When mainstream society hears of anarchism, they immediately think of, Rabachol and that whole tradition. we're still chained with it. But to me, it is not a paradox at all, because I think the basic tenets of contemporary anarchism and classical anarchism have a lot to teach us with which we can guide our conduct as individuals and as social beings. Let me, however, read one or two sentences. And that is from a brilliant introduction by George Woodcock, a very, very well-known anarchist writer, a Canadian, to a book written by Peter Kropotkin, the publishing company that Ali referred to, that I founded with others in 1969, has published the 11 volumes of Kropotkin's work, all of them, and is the only publisher that has also translated the famous previous to the last book of Kropotkin's, Le Parole des Révoltés, which actually George Woodcock translated from French into English. It's the only English edition. But Kropotkin, towards the end of his life in Moscow, in Russia, revolutionary Russia, was working on a very important book on ethics. It was going to be the first volume of a two-volume undertaking. And at the core of his ethics was something that he shared with Bakunin. And I will read from George Woodcock's introduction. We have to repeat this to ourselves, in my view, often enough. For him, as for Bakunin, people might not be naturally good, but are naturally social. And it was through this sociality that freedom could be achieved and safeguarded by people respecting each other's liberties in a society operated on the principles of mutual aid. This is not like Aristotle's famous quote, that man is a political animal. In the end, friends, this is what we have to focus on. How do we transform these values that most of us share into a living society and a living community? Well, I will recount to you my own experience. I was born, not physically, but spiritually, morally, if you will, in the 1960s. In the 1960s, in that very turbulent decades, there were two important driving principles. One was, and there were more than principles, there were actually political perspectives. One was participatory democracy. That is to say, the Port Huron Statement of 1964 said that it is not enough that we live in a society that practices consenting democracy, by which they meant a democracy where every 4 or 5 years you're asked to put a piece of paper in a box. That is not the democracy that we want. We want a democracy of citizen participation, which means that people should be part of a decision-making process that determines the priorities that they see for society. Directly participate in the decision-making process, not simply be consulted. The distinction is very important. And the idea of participatory democracy also hovered around the notion of direct democracy. But we can go into that a little later. So that was one driving, important political perspective. The second one was community organizing. How to develop the skills, how to develop the intelligence of working creatively with other people and bringing them together, especially the powerless, especially the poor, especially the unemployed. These two perspectives, of course, were complementary, and they fed on each other. In my experience, in a city that is roughly 2 million in population, and the larger city around 3 million people, the city is called Montreal. We had a number, as we were growing through that decade, we had a number of very important thinkers who came into that city. Amongst the first was a personal friend of Ali's called Henri Lefebvre. And Henri Lefebvre came at least 2 or 3 times to teach at Montreal universities. And there he taught us a number of very important things. The importance of space, especially urban space. And he also taught us that the politics of everyday life are the most important politics. That's where the political conscience begins, when people decide to grapple with the issues that affect their daily lives. Number one. Number two, another very important thinker that came to Montreal, this particular thinker I invited myself, was Paul Goodman, an anarchist. Paul Goodman collaborated with his brother Percival in a very important book called Communitas. And this book had many of the same perceptions of space through art, through a certain kind of architecture, through a certain kind of urban planning. And the second book that Goodman himself wrote was, of course, a monumental classic that influenced the whole decade of the 60s in a very profound way, called Growing Up Absurd. Mm-hmm. And I recommend that all of us here in this room who have not read it, not only should read it, but reread it, because it is the most devastating critique of the kind of educational experience that you folks live every year, every moment of your lives in the universities in which you are studying and teaching. It is a classic. And the third monumental thinker that I invited to the city after I met him accidentally, I won't go into the anecdotal part of my relationship with this extraordinary human being, was Murray Bookchin, who pioneered a very, very innovative and profoundly radical perspective called social ecology. I have here a definition of social ecology, but I won't go into it because I would have to read it because it's so succinct. But I will tell you this. It is a view of society and nature based upon a perspective of complementarity. That is to say, it is inconceivable from a social ecology point of view to transform our relationship to nature unless we ourselves transform ourselves and each other. In other words, we have to deconstruct our society to create a completely different relationship than the one that we have between young and old, between women and men, between the poor and the rich. All of this kind of reconstruction has to take place because our society, as a society, is at war with nature. In other words, we are net consumers of what nature can offer us, and we are net exporters of garbage back into nature, of waste into nature. This brings us to a very important geopolitical and spatial conclusion, namely that the two very dominant phenomena that have shaped the 20th century, especially the second half of the 20th century, namely massive dislocation and massive immigration, the people leaving the countryside, leaving towns and coming into big cities and big towns. This process of immigration, consider for example this very, very obvious statistic and how we deal with it. In the first 6 months of this year, 100,000 people crowded into southern Italy from Afghanistan, from Syria, from Iraq, from North Africa. 100,000 people are sitting there in camps waiting to get into Europe. In the last couple of days, you've read in the newspaper how the city of Calais in western France have crowded in there, living under the most despicable conditions with the objective of trying to cross the English Channel to get into England. So Europe, and I include Greece, Europe is just being battered by people from all over the world trying to get into our cities. And so this phenomenon is also global. And so the second important phenomena that we have to face with is urbanization. Cities are becoming bigger and bigger, and they're becoming less and less functional. All sorts of problems are affecting cities. Well, going back to Montreal, in 1968, would you believe, and there's a real irony in this particular date as it affects what I'm about to say. In 1968, a group of speculators had announced a major so-called urban renewal project in downtown Montreal. What the paradox and the irony is that this group of speculators in 1956 left the Communist Party. And of course, what did they decide to do? They decided to go into real estate, into insurance, to become rich. So they accumulated a 6-block area in the center of the city, and they announced, with the support of the Ford Foundation, with the support of the pension fund of the British postal workers, and with the financial support of the largest insurance company in Canada, that they were going to demolish the 6-block area and build the city of the 21st century. So a bunch of us, footloose radicals of the New Left, decided, no way, And we used the skills and techniques of community organizing, of starting a systematic door-to-door campaign to inform our fellow citizens of the danger of this important menace that was upon us. We were not going to let them do it. And I don't want to go through the whole 11-year struggle that it took. 11 years. 11 years of community organization and building alliances across the country, across the city rather, and the petitioning and the demonstrations and the civil disobedience and the arrests and the jailing and the trial. But after 11 years of all of this skillful work, we won. We actually won. And what did we win? We won and created a cooperative community. A cooperative community of 1,200 low-income people in 647 living units, decentralized into 22 housing, non-profit housing cooperatives. Non-profit housing cooperative, that is to say you cannot create equity, non-profit housing cooperatives, federated all together into a federation built on a land trust. Built on a land trust. Tied together by a very radical social contract, which at the core of which is that no low-income person is going to be displaced by anybody else in this whole project. The primary objective was to protect the housing of the low-income people who originally inhabited that area. The land trust in an urban space of a major city means that the land was collectivized. Can you imagine that? We removed 6 blocks of prime real estate in the center of the city off the marketplace. We took it away from market capitalism. There can be no buying or selling of any living unit within that 6 block area. We created, if you will, a commune, a Soviet, call it what you want. It electrified the real estate industry. They hated us before. They hate us even more now. And all the political interests behind them. And this project, this July 1st, we celebrated its 35th anniversary. It's still very much there, still very much thriving, and so on and so forth. I happen to be living in one of the cooperatives. I, of course, was one of the principal actors in all of that, in all modesty to say. I live in one of these cooperatives, in these housing cooperatives. And just to get back to some of the concerns that David raised earlier, it is a cooperative, a housing cooperative, which has 43 members. All decisions are made in a general assembly. We have a series of working committees dealing with maintenance, finance, external relations, and so on and so forth. We have, because it is a legal body, we are required to have a president. But over the 35-year history of our particular cooperative in this project, nobody knows who the president is because it's inconsequential. It is a very libertarian organization. And my friends, it is very impressive indeed when you see ordinary people, plumbers, electricians, déclassé intellectuals, the whole mixture, actually administer an annual budget for this cooperative alone of $1.5 million. When people tell me I can't understand a budget of this magnitude, I say that's bullshit, because the power structure always tells you, you know, it's too complicated for ordinary people. But when I see my neighbor, Monsieur Brezois, who is a plumber up the street in the hospital, deconstruct, take apart a budget and say, well, this is off a bit, can we adjust this, and so on and so forth, in a general assembly, believe me, to see that kind of participation is a transformative experience. And once this extraordinary project was put in place, people in the community said, well, what can we give back to the community at large, to the city at large? And there, in 1996, we established the Urban Ecology Center of Montreal, which was meant to put into practice the whole transformation that is at the base of social ecology. It transformed, for example, the environmental movement in Montreal, in Quebec, and in Canada by saying, well, we're all for saving forests, rivers, seals, whales, but we also have to deal with the urban ecology problems of our city. We have to deal with public transportation. We have to deal with air pollution. We have to deal with water pollution. We have to change how architecture constructs housing, and so on and so forth. In other words, we brought the thing back to the city. And so we raised the whole question of urban ecology as a centerpiece in the environmental and ecology movement. But we were not satisfied with that, because we cannot have, friends, an ecological city if it is not profoundly a democratic city. And we cannot have a democratic city if it is also not an ecological city. So how do we then proceed on the democratic front? Well, what happened was some very interesting ideas began popping up in Europe. Especially, of course, I'm not embarrassed at all to say, Barcelona. The cauldron of classical anarchism. The ideas are still percolating there. And there they put forward the whole notion of rights, urban rights, citizen rights. I have here a document which I'm sure none of you know about. It's called the European Charter for the Safeguarding of Human Rights in the City. This document explains and commits all cities who signed it to a concept of human rights in the city, whether it deals with gender, whether it deals with environment, whether it deals with housing, whether it deals with transportation, which is actually quite remarkable. And by the way, not being satisfied with that, there is now a World Charter of Human Rights to the City, which the Latin Americans pioneered, which is being very widely adopted in all sorts of cities across the world. Well, in Montreal, what we decided to do is take this proposition, which began melding into another movement of ideas called the Right to the City. The Right to the City is now an international movement, I digress a bit, pioneered by people like Margit Meyer in Berlin and Peter Marcuse, the son of, in New York, and David Harvey and people like that, but also it's a major force, social movement in many parts of the world. And I can go into that if you will. But in Montreal, what we did is, and all of these are initiatives by anarchists, by the way. What we did was we drafted at a meeting, because out of the Urban Ecology Center, what we decided to do is to have is to promote the idea of citizen summits, bringing together people to discuss common issues and to network towards social action. And the way it happened is as follows. In 2001, well, you've all heard of the Trilateral Commission. I won't get into that. And one of George's most hated persons wrote a disgusting essay as part of the work of the Trilateral Commission, where he said, and get this, he said, well, you know, all this democracy, all this participatory democracy that was permeating throughout the 60s has gone too far. This is a leading academic, Huntington. I think he taught at Harvard. It's gone too far, and we have to take measures in order to roll it back. And out of the Trilateral Commission, a nefarious conclave took place, which is called the World Economic Forum. The World Economic Forum, as you know, meets every year in Davos. It's not for you and me. It is for presidents and top executives of multinational corporations, of top bureaucrats, of prime ministers, of so-called statesmen. They meet there every year, and they determine what they want to do with the world economy. So in 2001, arising in part from the Battle of Seattle, social activists got together and they say, well, screw that. We're going to have a World Social Forum. And the World Social Forum had its first meeting in 2001 in an extraordinary city, not unlike Montreal, by the way, in many ways, both in ethnic composition and in terms of its political economy, in an extraordinary city called Porto Alegre in southern Brazil. And its first meeting, 2001, brought together 10,000 activists from around the world. And I sort of wrestled with the idea of going. I didn't have the money to do so, but I asked my friends, should I go, should I not go? And finally, money was put together, and I went. And I went, and it was a very interesting experience, because first of all, the municipal administration of Porto Alegre, of course, was controlled by the left. And Porto Alegre had already started something that was going to spread all over the place called the participatory budget, where a municipality submits its budgetary priorities to the discussion, to the influence of ordinary citizens. You know, people talk about people not being interested in politics. Well, you know, if you give people, ordinary people, the opportunity to decide what the economic priorities of their society is, believe you me, they get interested and they participate. So this city was the welcoming city to the first World Social Forum. And what struck me when I went there, finally, is that I opened up the program and I saw that this world gathering of 10,000 activists from around the world dealt with local problems, regional problems, and global problems, and relating all three together, global, regional, local. And I said, there's something very interesting about this approach, because I've attended many international conferences, and this was the first time where I saw this interplay of the different levels of politics. So when I got back to Montreal, I said, folks, let's try to do something like this. Very horizontal. The World Social Forum is not a decision-making venue. It is primarily a opportunity for people to get together and to network on various issues of concern and to set the wheels of activism along transnational lines. And so I got back to Montreal and I got my friends together, our comrades together at the Urban Ecology Center, and said, let's put together an association with various civil society organizations and have a citizens forum, a citizens summit, where ordinary people, activists, are brought together to discuss the politics of everyday life. That's what we did. And we did it successively over a number of years. We did five, but the city of Montreal, the administration, the municipal government became extremely nervous about all of this. And we got into a debate with them, when we got into dialogue with them, and to make a long story short, one of the things that I was asked to do is to put together a think tank to draw up a charter of citizen rights and responsibilities in the city of Montreal. And this is what we produced. A document, original, the only one in North America, where a city government admits to you and to me what their responsibilities are towards us in lucid, clear language. Very empowering for ordinary people. And there are rights there, by the way, that are applicable not only to Canadian citizens who live in the city of Montreal. You don't need a passport. Any person, including a homeless person, has the same rights as I do in the city of Montreal. And the most innovative political principle in this document, under the chapter Democracy, which I helped to write, of course, was the need of citizen initiative. That is to say, if a group of citizens get together at a borough level — Montreal, by the way, is the most decentralized, thanks to the urban left, is the most decentralized city in all of North America. We have 19 boroughs, 19 borough councils. Each council has its own budget, including the power of local taxation, if it chose to, and it's open and transparent to all the citizens to participate. Article 16 in this charter gives every citizen the right to initiative. You get a number of signatures together at the borough level, and you can put the borough on the defensive. Because what does citizens' initiative mean in the area of public policy? We create policy in between elections. You know, the election is an episode, but we want to participate in the decision-making process in between elections, going back to the notion of participatory democracy of the 60s. And so at the borough level you could do that, but you could also do it at the metropolitan level. So that, for instance, if according to the bylaw that the municipal council adopted, if you put together 15,000 signatures on a petition on a particular issue that you want to discuss, you can have a public consultation across the city of Montreal. Well, a group of radicals got together and they say, we want to transform Montreal and to develop a whole new dimension called urban agriculture. We want to bring agriculture into the city, on roofs, in gardens, in open spaces. And so they went out and they collected not 15,000 signatures, they collected 29,800 signatures. And how did they do that, by the way? This is very interesting. They occupied public spaces. In other words, because it was an official signature of the city of Montreal, they actually went in subways, in metro stations. They went in public libraries. They went in municipal buildings, on sidewalks. You know, you and I might have this similar experience. Try to collect try to set up a table on the street in London and collect a petition. Well, the bobby will be knocking on your shoulder within minutes. But in Montreal, you can occupy all of these public spaces, set up your tent, your table, and collect. It's not only simply collecting a signature, friends. It's also discussing with people the issues. learning the language of ordinary people and engaging with them, see what concerns them, what troubles them, how do they can become part of this process. So this is something that we pioneered, we anarchists pioneered in the city, and so we have this charter. And this charter has made such an impact that the city of Mexico developed a similar charter, and George Casafica's most beloved city, Guangzhou, inspired by the Charter of Montreal, developed its own charter too. I was invited there this spring, but for reasons of health I couldn't go, because they wanted to hear what our experience in Montreal was. So this is what I'm laying out to you as a perspective based upon concrete experience. And I want to say to you now that, and I'll conclude on this because I really want us to get into the discussion. I want to conclude to you by saying that this movement that has radiated throughout many cities across the country, across the planet, the right to the city, take over the city. This is what anarchists should do. They should take over their neighborhoods and take over the city, which does not exclude running for municipal elections, by the way, under certain circumstances. I'll drop in another anecdote. One day, Murray Bookchin was staying over at my house in Montreal. And it was, I think, 2 o'clock in the morning. Well, all of a sudden, I hear this cry from his bedroom. Dimitri! What's going on? I rush into the bedroom. And what does he have? He has a quotation. He had in this book a quotation from Michael Bakunin on municipal elections are near to the people. Now, Murray pioneered a great deal in the area of social ecology, and is, to me, his most brilliant political work is Urbanization Without Cities, followed by a synthetic book called The Politics of Social Ecology. He didn't hesitate, even in the most darkest anarchist circles, to advocate political action and political work at the municipal level, including running for elections under certain circumstances. Well, he was condemned for that. He was harassed for that. And so when he discovered the quotations from Bakunin that said exactly that, the centrality of the municipality, he was delirious with joy, and we sat up drinking vodka until 4:30 in the afternoon, 4:30 in the morning, celebrating this magnificent discovery in a book that was published by Black Rose Books by Sam Dalgo. All this to say that political action is very important under certain circumstances, of course, and the conclusion of my comments is that this phenomena of migration and urbanization is being recognized more and more, to the point, and I will conclude with this, to the point as follows. The International Federation of Cities is now in the process of negotiating with the United Nations to have cities admitted in the official structure of the United Nations. Can you imagine the implications of that? That is to say, the nation state has been put into question at the heart of an organization that they've been controlling since the end of the Second World War, and saying, well, look, certain major issues, like environmental issues, which are being dealt with to the extent that they're being dealt with more effectively by cities than nation states, have to sit around the table to discuss things. And so if that goes forward, we're going to see some extraordinary things to be able to discuss as anarchists. Thank you.